everyone. I'm Nan Hien, board member of the club. Sorry to interrupt your lunch, but I'm just going to get this started. But before I begin, can I just ask everyone to switch off any of their devices, any phones, turn it off to silent. Also, on upcoming events, this Wednesday, we've got Lincoln Leung to talk about what lies ahead for Hong Kong's rail links with China. Please come to that. In the last century, China has turned its back on Confucianism, but that has changed. That's changed since Xi Jinping became China's current leader. The present support of virtues espoused by the ancient philosopher has been highly publicized, but is the comeback of Confucianism in Chinese culture and politics for real? And what does it mean for China's future? Our speaker will answer these questions based on his four-year research for his latest book, Confucius and the World He Created. Michael Schumann is a Beijing-based freelance journalist who writes about Asia and the global economy, and he wrote an earlier book, The Miracle, the epic story of Asia's quest for wealth. Let's hear what he has to say. Everyone, give a warm welcome to Michael.
Thank you, everybody, for coming today. And thank you very much, the FCC, for organizing this. Okay. So I'm kind of like President Obama. I use a little teleprompter here. Okay. Confucius in China. If you want to learn about Confucius in modern China, there's no better place to start than in the small town of Chufu in Shandong province. It was there 2,500 years ago when China's greatest philosopher first shared his humanist teachings with his disciples, the ideas that would later shape Chinese civilization itself. Chufu had been a center of Confucian learning ever since. When the great Han Dynasty historian Sima Qian visited Chufu on a research trip around 100 BC, he discovered a community of scholars there committed to studying the sage's teachings. Confucius's home had been converted into a museum shrine with his clothes, books, and other personal items reverently on display. The scholars made sacrifices to Confucius at his gravesite, which you can still visit on the outskirts of the town. Confucius is the focus of such study and worship in Chufu today as well. Just inside the restored walls of the old city is the Chufu Confucian Institute. There, its founder, a local resident named Duan Yanping, implores his students to memorize the Analects, just as teachers had done for centuries during the old dynasties. One room of the institute houses traditional yellow robes, which Duan uses to recreate ancient temple ceremonies. And another is splattered with paint from calligraphy classes. In the future, he told me, China should rely on Confucian culture to expand and develop its prosperity. Yet in recent times, Confucius has not always been so revered in China, not even in his hometown of Chufu. Inside the town's Confucian temple, which is in an appropriately sedate and quiet series of pavilions, perfect for contemplation, you can still see the damage done by Red Guards during the Cultural Revolution. In 1966, the guards, their mission to destroy the Four Olds, descended on Chufu and ransacked the temple. They dragged the statue of Confucius from the main shrine and tossed it into a bonfire. If you look carefully, you can still see graffiti splattered on the pavilions and stele by the Red Guards. Today, though, the statue of Confucius had been replaced. And it isn't rabid Red Guards who visit the temple, but curious tourists. In fact, the government is encouraging them to visit. The new high-speed train darting between Beijing and Shanghai conveniently stops in Chefoo, transforming what was an arduous journey into a comfortable 2-hour jaunt from the capital. Outside the gates of the Confucian Temple, you can find the Annex of Confucius Recital Center. Opened by the city government, the center offers free tickets to the temple to anyone who can regurgitate a few passages from the Annex. Obviously, the present communist leadership really wants Chinese today to know more about Confucius, his words, and his ideals. Yes, Confucius is back in modern China. What explains this dramatic turnaround in China's attitude towards Confucius? And what does this comeback of Confucius mean for China's future? These questions are critical for China at this moment in its history. If we witness a true revival of Confucius in China, that would have huge implications for the nation's politics, culture, and society. The comeback of Confucius in China is first and foremost the result of a dramatic shift in attitude towards the great sage by the Chinese Communist Party. The founders of the Communist Party had been among the leaders of a movement against Confucius that emerged after the collapse of the Qing Dynasty in 1911. To them, Confucius was to blame for just about everything wrong with China. Its outdated political system, its poverty, its embarrassing weakness before the West, its poor treatment of women, and its inability to adapt to the modern world. One of the party's founders wrote in 1916 of Confucius that, quote, "The ethics he promoted is the ethics of the feudal age. The objectives, ethics, social norms, mode of living, and political institutions did not go beyond the privilege and prestige of a few rulers and aristocrats and had nothing to do with the happiness of the great masses." When students of the May 4th movement marched in protest, they shouted, "Destroy the old curiosity shop of Confucius." When the communists took control of China in 1949, they also gained the power to put their anti-Confucius ideas into practice. What began was the most concerted effort to purge Confucius from Chinese society and the nation's history. Confucian texts were burned and temples desecrated. The attacks reached its height during the anti-Confucius campaign of the early 1970s. Government propaganda posters and art portrayed Confucius as a purveyor of death, often as a skeleton or surrounded by tombstones or snakes. One booklet for second graders tells a story of good Red Guards using an effigy of Confucius to practice shooting their rifles. Mao and his cadre saw Confucius' enduring influence in society was holding the nation back from entering a glorious communist future. One article in the Peking Review in 1975 said that Confucius' ideas, quote, "must be demolished, and traditional concepts of the exploited classes must be destroyed. Only then can the new ways of the proletariat be established and the communist revolutionary spirit brought into full play." That was published in 1975. Now time warped to today. Rather than vilifying Confucius, President Xi Jinping and his padre cadres are praising him. Xi quotes Confucius so often He sounds more like a Ming scholar official than a Marxist. In 2014, on Confucius' birthday, he endorsed Confucian ideas in a speech at a Confucian conference in no less a venue than the Great Hall of the People. Ancient wisdom like Confucianism, he said, quote, can offer beneficial insights for governance and wise rule. In 2013, she made his own pilgrimage to Chifu, just like so many of the old emperors had, where he visited the mansion that was once home to Confucius' descendants and promised to read Confucian texts. She then is engineering what is, in effect, a cultural counter-revolution, a return to the very traditions the party had once tried to forcibly purge from Chinese society. Why the turnaround? The reality is that China's Communist Party today needs Confucius, much like the emperors of yesteryear did. Sure, the Communist Party has been remarkably successful in building China into a new superpower. But despite that success, or perhaps actually more accurately, because of the party's success, it is facing a legitimacy crisis. Though officially still wedded to Marxist ideology, the ideas of Marx and Engels are hard to reconcile with the number of Ferraris on the streets of Beijing and Shanghai. The party has also the party has also pinned its right to govern on the stellar record of economic growth and development, the rising incomes and tens of millions of jobs that it has created. But slowing growth is undermining that strategy too. And of course, she is fearful about the effect of Western ideas about democracy and human rights. He has made clear that the right course for China can only be found in China's own past. She once told the Politburo that, quote, to solve China's problems, we can only search in the land of China for the ways and means that suit it. And nothing is more Chinese than Confucius. For roughly 19 centuries, Confucius's teachings acted as the basic ideology for China's imperial dynasties. Civil servants had to memorize the Confucian classics to pass the exams to get their jobs. Confucius offered the emperors a way to portray themselves as benevolent while encouraging loyalty and social order. So it seems only natural that President Xi would return to Confucius today. In doing so, he can paint his government as the natural successor to thousands of years of Chinese political history based on an undeniably authentic Chinese political tradition. Xi, though, wants to do more than just promote Confucius. He wants to teach Chinese the correct interpretations of that ancient philosophy for today's China. Just last August, a book of Xi's writings and speeches on the importance of Confucius in ancient Chinese philosophy was published, in English no less, and the title is Xi Jinping, How to Read Confucius and Other Chinese Classical Thinkers. The communists don't want a wholesale return of Confucius to society. They want to promote what they see as the good elements and discard what they call the dross. The Confucius that Xi and his cadres would prefer today's Chinese to know is one that they believe is supportive of the status quo. That's why they talk all the time about a harmonious society, a very Confucian-sounding principle used in a very modern context. Like the old emperors, the current government is promoting the idea of filial piety, a core Confucian concept that was employed since the days of the Han Dynasty, 2,000 years ago, to foster obedience to the state. In 2012, a commentary in the People's Daily proclaimed that, quote, only those who respect their parents, are loyal to their countries. There are some in China who see this odd match between communists and Confucianism as a good thing. Scholar Zhang Weiwei talks of a new model of government in which the bureaucracy of the party and state infused and guided by Confucian morality will produce some sort of superior form of governance. Confucian thinker Zhang Qing has laid out a blueprint for a future Chinese Confucian government that mixes a form of Western participatory government with Confucian ideals of meritocracy and rule by the educated elite. But for those who would prefer to see China head in a different direction, to become more open and even more democratic, the return of Confucius may seem to be a bad thing. Once again, Confucius is being used by a regime to justify illiberal political practices and then tell the citizens that the nation's history requires that just such a government should exist. Even more, the comeback of Confucius could mean a revival of all sorts of outdated ideas associated with the great sage. Fairly or unfairly, most of all, the second-class status of women. In the Analects, Confucius infamously says that, quote, women and servants are most difficult to nurture. If one is close to them, they lose their reserve, while if one is distant, they feel resentful. 2,500 years later, and Confucius still hasn't lived that one down. Yet I'd argue that the comeback of Confucius is potentially a positive for China. I think that those of us living in China can see that it is the country that has lost its way. Sure, China is a rising superpower with 1.3 billion people, getting richer by the minute, even in a slowing economy. Yet there's something missing. Maybe we can call it a sense of direction or purpose or some overarching guiding principles. People in China talk about it all the time. The country, they complain, has been gripped by a desire to get rich. That spawned all sorts of nastiness, from endemic corruption, fraud, environmental degradation. Chinese complain that the people around them have stopped caring about each other and society overall. Many I've talked to about this blame the infusion of Western values. Rampant American materialism is to blame. As one manager of an automobile association told me, the American dream has influenced Chinese people to admire success, but the Chinese people didn't learn the substance of the dream. They only learned to get things for yourself. I'd argue that what has really happened in China is something else, the loss of Confucius. When those Red Guards were tearing apart the Confucian temple in Chufu, they were also shredding the moral fiber of Chinese society. Confucius had provided the basic principles of social interaction in China for centuries. In the West, we had the Ten Commandments to provide the laws of humanity. In China, it was Confucian philosophy that told people what is right and wrong. The Confucian way was the way of the gentleman. Confucius himself became a paragon of virtue. Being a good person and following his own example. Amid the stifling pollution in Beijing and in recurrent food scandals, perhaps a bit more Confucian morality isn't such a bad idea. That's exactly how some Chinese feel. On the outskirts of Beijing, you can find the Sihai Confucius Academy, which offers an old-fashioned intensive education in the Confucian classics alongside modern subjects like math and science. Schoolmaster Feng Jie got the idea for the school while he was working as a publisher. He began printing translations of the Chinese classics and was so inspired by them that he felt the need to teach them to a new generation of Chinese. In order to save China, the people have to start with a cultural revival, Feng told me. What Feng is talking about is actually part of something much bigger, much grander, and much more important for Asia. For much of the past 150 years, being modern meant copying the ways of the West. Traditional Asian ideas on society, politics, and business were seen as outdated, irrelevant, and even dangerous. They could hold Asia back from a better, richer future. Now that's changing. The unparalleled economic success of East Asia, and specifically the society's influence by Confucius, has convinced many to reassess their own cultural traditions. Kishore Mahbubani at the National University of Singapore calls this cultural confidence. Now being modern and successful no longer means being Western. Asians can be Asian and modern at the same time. It is a major shift in thinking throughout the region, which could lead to a rejuvenation of Confucius and his thought and practices. Where that leads, nobody can tell. In China, the comeback of Confucius is not just a government propaganda campaign. The new openness to Confucius has convinced many ordinary Chinese to seek out the sage for themselves, people like Feng Jie. The big question facing China then is what they'll find during their rediscovery. The fact is that there is no one Confucius, but many Confuciuses who have been conjured up over by countless scholars and thinkers over the generations for all sorts of purposes. The government of Xi Jinping is promoting one of those Confuciuses, the Confucius of the imperial state. But which Confucius will Chinese readers discover as they again pore over the pages of the Analects? They could discover another Confucius, the Confucius who preached benevolence and righteousness, who spent his life trying to reform government to be more fair and more just. Let's recall for a moment who Confucius actually was, as revealed to us in the Analects and other classical texts. He spent his life not serving kings he considered greedy, self-serving, or coercive, but criticizing them, often right to their faces. That's why he spent almost all of his life as a teacher rather than a government servant, which is a job that he really wanted. In fact, at one point during his life, he wandered from state to state across China for 13 years, looking for a noble prince to employ him and take his advice. Ultimately, a quest that ended in vain. The Confucius, then, the sages of comeback in China, may not be the one Xi Jinping wants. Or maybe modern Chinese will find an entirely new Confucius for a new age, one that has special meaning for them in a time of great change. Or so maybe we could hope. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. I'm going to open this up to the floor. If the mic reaches you, could you identify yourself and the organization that you're with? So, Keith first.
Keith Bradshaw, New York Times, and a member of the board. Hong Kong has an interesting historical connection with Confucius, the greatest Western translator, arguably, of Confucius, and leading scholar of Confucius in the 19th century was James Legge, who was here for much of the century. But more recently, I think many in Hong Kong, as in the last couple of weeks, are concerned about a different aspect about Chinese power, which is the five missing booksellers. I wish I knew more about Confucius, but I'm wondering, because I'll confess, read the Analects in more than a piece of them, but is there anything in Confucius that provides a basis that some might turn to for a system of checks and balances, not just urging the government to be benevolent or fair, but to have checks and balances? Or do you see Confucius really lending himself to the kind of interpretation primarily that's being given by Beijing, which is one that emphasizes filial piety, harmonious society, and fairly authoritarian rule?
You've touched on one of the, what I think a lot of people would say is one of the great failings of Confucius' political thought. He spent a lot of time talking about what should happen and how kings should behave and what makes for moral government, but he didn't talk a lot about how to get there. What happens if your king isn't benevolent? What exactly are you supposed to do? Confucius, in his own life, chose basically to withdraw once he found he wasn't making progress in reforming the way the government was run, that he basically picked up left and tried someplace else. That's not very useful in getting a government to adhere to kind of Confucian principles. So I think that's one failing that you're getting at. I think the other aspect of it is that, you know, when you look at how the Chinese government and uses Confucius, it's very much like how the imperial government before him used Confucius, and they're focusing a lot on hierarchy, loyalty to the state, obedience, social order. If you go back and you read even the original kind of classical text, you can see where they're getting at it, all of this. You can see where this has come from, what aspects of Confucian thought have led to these types of ideas. I'd argue after reading it that it's a misinterpretation that Confucian relationships were supposed to be reciprocal. So yeah, you were supposed to be loyal to the emperor, but the emperor was supposed to be just and fair and benevolent. So that basically your loyalty and obedience is conditional. That's the way I would read it. That's how a lot of people read it. But the way that governments have read it over the years is that reciprocal nature relationship has conveniently gotten pushed to the side. And that's what you're seeing happen today. And then the question becomes, if you're going to follow Confucian principles, what do you do about all of this? He didn't say much about it. If you can get though back, move forward into Mencius. And Mencius was a little bit more explicit on this, where certain people have read Mencius as saying that it is okay to overthrow your government. It is okay to protest. There's a passage in Mencius where someone asked him, I'm sorry, I, unlike all those scholars all those years, I did not memorize these texts, so I paraphrase. Someone asked Mencius what he thinks of a king that was killed, I believe, by his own brothers. And Mencius said something like, I've never heard of a king by that name who was killed. I only know of an ordinary person, and therefore it's okay. And the message was basically, because this guy wasn't a very good king, he didn't have the right to be called a king, and therefore didn't demand the respect and stature that a king would have. So that's what makes kind of Confucian teaching so interesting, where you see the government today in China attempting to use certain aspects of it. But what happens when you really open the door to this stuff? You get people reading all these ideas. And where does that lead, and how does that influence people's thinking towards their own government? That's what's going to be interesting, as the government in China seems very intent on continuing to push Confucian thought. How does this play out over the next 10-15 years?
Any more questions?
Hi, I'm Edith Terry. This is an observation and a question, and I hope I'm not too long-winded with the observation. I think you really need to differentiate between the folk religion that's associated with Confucianism and this sort of quasi-Confucian ideology that is being promoted currently. So in 1981, when I lived in Beijing, I went to visit the Confucian shrine at Mount Tai. Now, China basically reopened the doors to religion at the same time as it launched the economic reforms. So this folk shrine, fertility shrine at the top of Mount Tai, was absolutely packed. Last year, I went to visit the Confucian Academy and the main Confucian shrine in Beijing for the first time, and they were deserted. They're right down the street from the Yonghegong Lamasery, which was packed. So the observation is, it's actually been, the door has been open to Confucianism for at least as long as the economic reforms have been on. I don't see any, and this leads to the question, my, you know, sort of quick jaunt through the Confucian Academy and its lack of tourists, Chinese tourists, kind of said to me that if Chinese have the Chinese, as a result of the disruption of the Cultural Revolution and communism and so forth, have a great hunger for religion, it's certainly not expressing itself with a grassroots Confucian revival. So question is, do you see that from your standpoint in Beijing or rest of China?
I mean, it's really hard to judge what 1.3 billion people are thinking about this. You know, and then you get into, even in the West, I mean, how many people read Plato on a regular basis? But I've been surprised just on an anecdotal level in recent years about how people are taking greater interest in Confucius. And a lot of it is because of the changing attitude of the government that, you know, now it's considered basically being politically okay. You know, to give you an idea, I've met people who've started book clubs where they read not just Confucian texts, but classical philosophy generally, and those are relatively new as in the last few years. I've met people who plan Confucian events and they talk about how much more support that they get from universities and schools and colleges. There's all kinds of new little Confucian schools that are popping up for kids that their parents are bringing them to. Some of them are government, most of them are not. And then you see the numbers of tourists, like going to Chifu, has increased dramatically. You're seeing millions of people a year going there. You know, there's a new Shangri-La hotel that just opened over in that town. So, I was having dinner about a year ago with the woman who runs the Ford Foundation, and they allow their staff of about 15 people or so to 14, 15 people. To choose a place to travel to every year, and the foundation pays for it. And that year they had chosen Chifu. So you see this on kind of an anecdote. It's just on an anecdotal level, but my sense of it is that the government is encouraging people to revisit it, and at least some of them are. How seriously they're going to take it, you know, what influence it has on their thinking. It's something that it's going to play out over time, but my sense is that it's not just a government propaganda effort, that it is leading to something more widespread where people are really revisiting it, and we'll see where it goes.
Any more more questions? Yeah.
Sarah Monk's a member of the club. How do you see the Confucian academies overseas fitting into this, the Confucius Institutes, and also the rather strange Confucius Prize, which has been raised as an alternative to the Nobel? And back on the domestic side, perhaps a follow-up to Edith's question, how do you see the following for almost contemporaries of Confucius, the Buddha and Lao Tzu, how do you see this coming up? Is it going to be like a competition over these ancient wisdom traditions and scholars?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that second.
The second question is whether the Buddhism seems to be acquiring more following in China at the moment, and whether you think there will be almost like a competition between, say, Confucianism, Buddhism, and people following Lao Tzu, also a contemporary of Confucius.
Okay, I got it. Thanks, yeah, sorry. In terms of the Confucian Institutes, well, you know, they really have nothing to do with Confucius. I mean, it's just the government's way of using, I mean, they use Confucius almost like a brand because they know the world has a certain image of Confucius as kind of a pacifist and his wisdom, and he's a kind of a symbol of China's great history. So he's a very easy kind of brand to slap on stuff, but there's not a whole lot of Confucius being taught at these things. I don't know. I mean, I think what's going on with the Confucian Institutes is fascinating, where they're obviously spreading like crazy. And at the same time, there is, I think, at least a mini backlash against them, especially in the U.S., where you've seen some fairly prominent universities, Penn State, University of Chicago, I believe, have dropped their relationships. I think they're controversial, especially in the U.S., because what you're really doing is that you're effectively outsourcing your Chinese studies program to the Chinese government, and that's unusual to do for a U.S. university with anything. You don't, most academic programs are not, and universities in the U.S. are not run by any outside entity, so it's just unusual to start with, and then it's even more unusual that the entity you're outsourcing to is basically another government. I think they're going to stay controversial, at least in the Western Europe and the U.S. In terms of the other question, I mean, I think what you're absolutely right. I mean, the return to tradition in China is definitely not just Confucius. You see a huge surge of interest in Buddhism and Taoism and other traditions. And the government as well is promoting aspects of this. Xi Jinping quotes not just Confucius, but all kinds of classical thinkers from different schools. I don't think there's so much of a competition going on. I mean, these are traditions that have coexisted in China for a couple thousand years, and they probably will continue to. But it is part of a greater trend of this resurrection of traditions that were once denigrated in China. And where does that lead Chinese society going forward?
I am Martin Mertz. I'm a club member, not a member of the press. I think that the mid-70s anti-Confucian movement gives a lot of insight into what's happening now, because it wasn't just anti-Confucius. It was Pi Lin, Pi Kong, criticise Lin Biao and attack Confucius. Lin Biao was, of course, already dead in the water, but many people took the Confucius to be a reference to Zhou Enlai, who was at that moment dying of bladder cancer. And so it was what was later called the Gang of Four's attempt to blacken the name of Zhou Enlai and try and bring him down. And so soon after that, when Zhou Enlai died in January 76, and then in April 76, there were massive outpouring of public disgust at the Gang of Four for attacking Zhou Enlai. And I think that the Gang of Four was using this campaign as a fig leaf of respectability to carry forward a political campaign. And would you say that the current promotion of Confucius is also just a fig leaf of respectability for an authoritarian regime's ongoing practice of being authoritarian?
I'm not sure I got your question exactly, but the look, I think what the Chinese government is trying to do is fascinating. I mean, they're trying to do a total kind of about face in their attitude towards their own history, and they're doing so in a very, you know, it's what the Chinese government is doing is very reminiscent of what Lee Kuan Yew tried to do in the 1980s and 1990s in Singapore. Which is basically use, you know, his Asian values argument. So it's basically claiming that because of Asian cultural tradition that you know, those kind of Western ideas about democracy on basically aren't the right cultural fit or historical fit, and that you know, especially Americans tend to think of democracy as universal. And his argument was, well, actually that's not the case, because democracy is a culture, is an outgrowth of a certain history and culture in the West, and that's not our history and culture, and we have a different history and culture. And our history and culture, which is mainly Confucius, says that our governments and our country should be run differently, and our citizens want a different type of government. That was the next big step, that it's not just what the governments want, but this is what actually the people want. And when you see what's going on today in China is more or less the same thing. The idea that, you know, our government is a traditionally Chinese form of government, and, you know, what you want us to be from the outside isn't us. It's, you know, it's fascinating that it's coming from a government that claims to be Marxist, which is also a Western idea, but we'll leave that aside. So, you know, the Lee Kuan Yew Asian values argument had held quite a bit of sway and is an interesting idea in terms of saying that not all people are going to want the same government, and that's true. But at the same time, I think you see why what's going on in Singapore and the rest of Asia, that people in Asia actually do want the same civil liberties and freedoms that we have in the West. And I think that's what's going on here in Hong Kong. So I think the question for China is that does this cultural revival by the government and what Xi Jinping is attempting to do, does it actually serve the purpose it's meant for, or does it not? And what dangers does it hold in and of itself when you really kind of start delving into what Confucius said and did, and how does that contradict what the government's trying to do with Confucian thought? It's all very interesting, and it is really going to play a big role, I think, in Chinese politics in the next 20 years.
One more question at the front. Can I just ask to keep the questions concise, because we're running out of time?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, my name is Beng Johansson. I'm a member of the club. My question is, can Confucianism be reformed? A successful religions and philosophies adapt to social changes. You mentioned the serious flaw that Confucianism gives women a second place in society. Mm. Is there a trend? Is it possible to reform Confucianism? You mentioned there were many currents, and Xi Jinping's only represented one of them.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a really interesting idea.
Don't answer yet. Oh, I'm sorry, Michael, can we get all the other questions and you answer them as a group for the last question? We'll try to combine. If there's another one right behind you, Mark, there we go.
This could confuse you, completely unrelated. Michael, I just want to turn away slightly from China because Keith had mentioned Hong Kong, but are there other places in Asia that are also Confucian, maybe even more so? Because when I was in graduate school, some of my professors talked a lot about Korea, and my experience in Korea does reinforce that. Just wonder what your view was on that as well.
And Peter is one more over here, but can you wait for the mic?
Just a very simple question, Michael. What bureau or administration in the Chinese government administers or regulates Confucianism?
Which?
What bureau? Is it under the Bureau of Religious Affairs, or is it handled in another? Yeah, who determines what is the acceptable Confucianism?
Yeah. I'm actually not exactly sure. I mean, I think there's various I think there's a Ministry of Culture that's very heavily involved, and they run a lot of the temples and things like that. But you know, also as you see, this is coming really straight from the top as well, where the leaders you often see talking about are Xi Jinping and the other really top leaders. So it's pretty pervasive in the government. In terms of the question about elsewhere, yeah, I mean, there are other parts of Asia that haven't gone through the cultural upheavals that China has. So I did a lot. That's why I did a lot of research on my book and in Korea, actually, where you see some things that I think have progressed more naturally. And I think what's also interesting is that the government in Korea is also pushing Confucian ideas. They're reviving these old these little schools around the country that used to be where people studied for the civil service exams, and now they're being turned into little kind of family community education centers where they're teaching filial piety again and kind of basic Confucian family concepts. So it's interesting. The government there is trying to do similar things for similar reasons to what the Chinese government is doing. In terms of the first question, I think that's fascinating. You know, there are people in the scholarly world who deal with Confucianism who say, hey, you know, Confucianism needs a reformation in the same way that other doctrines have. That of course anything that existed that was first really developed 2,500 years ago is going to have aspects of it that don't really it may not be valid today or out of date. And you know, look. In the West, in the Bible, there's lots of stuff that we don't really adhere to anymore. You know, if we followed the Bible, we'd still be owning slaves, for example, but we don't do that. So, you know, we look to the Bible and we find things in it that are universal and that mean things for us today. And Confucianism has not gone through that process because of the way that it was so denigrated and attacked by reformers for much of the last 100 years, 150 years. But now that's also changing, where you do see scholars and different thinkers are going back and they're rewriting, they're writing books on kind of, you know, the new Confucianism. I dealt with one scholar at University of Hawaii who's writing books on how Confucianism can be adapted for gender parity, for example. So that actually is going on in a scholarly way. It'll be interesting to see if it actually takes hold on a more popular level, kind of a Confucian like Renaissance or Reformation.
Thank you, Michael. That was an insightful talk and a token of our appreciation. Here you go.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you for doing this.
No worries.
Yeah.
Michael.